Welcome back, everyone, to the Medieval Irish History Podcast. I am joined today for our special St. Bridget's Day episode. So just a day early, special treat for anybody who really, you know, has to get her St. Bridget's fix on the actual feast day of St. Bridget. I am joined today, my very special guest is Professor Catherine McKenna from Harvard. I better give you your official title there, Catherine. It's the Margaret Brooks Robinson Professor of Celtic Languages and Literatures. You've been at Harvard for a very long time. and it would take me too long to list all of your great work and research. But one of the most important aspects for today is, well, you've been working on Bridget really on and off for your whole career, haven't you? Kind of in a way. But you are
close
working.
Close to, yes.
Yeah. But you are working on a book at the moment on the development of the cult of Bridget, kind of from the early Middle Ages all the way up to modern day.
That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah. It's kind of a crazy scope, but I'm trying to make it work.
Yeah, well, we're all going to be very excited to see that when it comes out. And of course, this year we are celebrating the 1500th commemorations of the anniversary of the death of St. Bridget. So, Professor McKenna, Catherine, will we start off? Do we want to talk a little bit about that date? You know, about who was St. Bridget and where we're coming up with the 1500 from this year in 2024?
Yes. Well, we've got some birth dates for her in the annals, don't we? And she's supposed to have lived to the age of 70.
Yeah.
A good age,
yeah.
in those days, really, that would bring her death date down to 524. So there we are. And it's interesting because then we see her as belonging to the very first generation of Christians in Ireland. That
yes.
is to say, she's just a generation younger than St. Patrick, right? And
yeah.
In some of the sources, she meets Patrick and negotiates with him and talks with him and so on. But she's that bit younger, but belongs to the very first generation of Christians in Ireland, and is also the founder of one of the most important ecclesiastical foundations in early medieval Ireland, the Church of Kildare.
Yeah,
which is attributed to her from the very earliest sources we have.
Yeah, and I'm kind of glad you stressed that point, because that's actually probably partly answers the kind of the bigger question that, you know, we'll be covering in this, you know, this today, of why she's so important. And I think possibly part of the reason is because she's from that very early period of Christianization in Ireland, and, you know, one of those early generations. And while you said that she's put forward in some of the texts as having, you know, interacted with Patrick or been mates with Patrick or, you know, different kind of interactions with Patrick, while that we have no historical evidence that may or may not have happened, there's certainly the dates add up in terms of that she would have been a younger contemporary of his.
Correct, yes. Yes, and we do know that her church became very important. I mean, we know that from the 8th century, which is clearly, you know, a couple of hundred years after she died, but still that we have a document that suggests that her church in Leinster was as important as Patrick's church in Armagh was for the north. So, very important figure in early medieval Ireland, and remarkable given the situation of women
yeah.
in that period, that she was able to establish a religious, an ecclesiastical foundation that became so important.
Yeah, so to any of us kind of early medieval, you know, scholars of early medieval Ireland, you know, Bridget and Kildare, you know, loom large over this whole period. And while Patrick has kind of since then taken over, and we in another episode we can talk about, you know, that he had such a great PR machine behind him at Armagh, you know, from maybe the 7th century onwards. In maybe the earlier, let's say, 600s, for all we know, based on the evidence we have, Kildare, it was all about Kildare and Bridget, you know, and that she was, you know, Armagh's making out like they were always the biggest church in Ireland and that Patrick was the obvious patron saint. But I feel like it was touch and go there for a while, and that actually Bridget, you know, was, could have been our patron saint, you know, could have been the biggest saint in Ireland at that time.
Exactly. And as it is, it takes a while before she becomes established as one of the three patron saints of Ireland, along with Patrick and Columba. But I agree with you that in her own time and for hundreds of years afterwards, she was just as important. We know that a reverence for Bridget spread with the Irish monks who were traveling abroad all over Europe and into Italy. We have one life of Bridget written in Italy, and yeah, and copies of lives in Latin that were presumably written in Ireland, but that we know about because they survive in manuscripts in European libraries. You know, some like 70 manuscript copies, yeah, of the earliest life that we have. So she was a big deal.
Yeah, she was much more global in the Middle Ages than Patrick, wasn't she?
Yeah, she seems to have been.
Yeah.
She seems to have been.
People loved her and continued to her.
And that seems to be one of the ways that people, one of the reasons why people begin to question,
yes,
whether,
okay,
she was real or not.
She
was.
She got too big. Yeah, she got too big, too famous. You know, we're going to have to take her down a couple of notches. Let's get into that. So, because there is no easy answer as to why Bridget really captures the imagination. We can explore that, but we're not going to solve that all now, you know, in the next half an hour. But what were, so, okay, this is kind of then a two-pronged question for you, Catherine. So one, how do we account for perhaps then how big, how widespread her cult gets? But also, and when we say cult, I should say, when we're getting into, you know, when we talk about saints, and in different episodes, and just in general as medieval historians, it has a negative, the word cult has negative connotations, and, you know, in the modern era, but really in the medieval period, it's just, you know, the cultus, you know, it's just the kind of the veneration of, you know, the saint, of a particular saint or the saints in general, and it's not, it's in what we're talking about, it's just an integrated part of the institution that is the church. It's not something weird and offbeat and, you know, irreverent or anything. So before anybody starts to get upset when we talk about the cult of Bridget or anything, but why, you kind of implied there that, yeah, maybe she got so big that some people are claiming that she didn't even exist. So there's kind of a two-pronged question there for you. Explore that. Why do they? Some people claim she didn't exist, and how do we account for how big she got?
Well, one of the ways in which people bring up evidence that she didn't exist is they'll say, "Well, we have writings by Saint Patrick, and we have a life by Athafnan of Columba that is written within 100 years of his death. But Bridget doesn't seem to have written anything. And the earliest story of her life that we have is probably, you know, is more like maybe 150 years after her death. Well, that doesn't convince me of much of anything,
yeah,
you know, because there are plenty of people who existed who didn't write things that we have. So that's part of it. When I actually first got interested in Bridget because of this very question, like how did she go from being a historical woman in the scholarly literature to being erased or just relegated to the status of she was a goddess, but she's gone. And my research suggests that this happened more or less at the end of the 19th century.
Okay.
And that then, when we first get a French scholar, Gerbois de Jumainville,
Yeah.
writing his book about gods and mythology of the Celts in French, but then translated into to English within a decade or so. And he's found the references. And we do have a few references here and there in early literature to a goddess named Brigg or Brigid, who is associated with smithcraft and poetry and medicine. And it is Gerbois de Jumainville, as far as I can tell, who first identifies that goddess referenced in a 10th century text, so way after the time of Saint Bridget, that goddess with the saint. And then that gets picked up by Maud Gonne, the great
Yeah.
icon of the of Yeats's poetry, in as she founds this nationalist women's organization, Unionen Herren, and she says we're going to have Bridget in both aspects, as goddess and as saint, as the patron of this organization. And to my mind, what she's doing, and it's very honorable objective, is trying to bring together to make the nationalist cause a cause that is not associated with either the Roman Catholic Confession or the Church of Ireland Confession, but to find a sort of neutral, non-partisan
Yeah.
Bridget, as it were, who is the goddess. And it seems to me that it goes from there, but that you then get this sort of let's take her down a peg more and more as you move into
In
the
the 20th
20th and the
century.
late 20th century.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
Yeah. And
absolutely.
it's funny because that's been really revealing, Catherine. Thank you, because I didn't know any of that. Because when you just approach the medieval sources, all of these, she's very clearly a historical individual, and she's very clearly a saint, and she's very really above all else. Well, it depends, I suppose, on the specific text, but she's the founder of Kildare, and everybody who follows her in Kildare is expressed in terms of, the successor of Bridget. And so I've been perplexed since I've been asked to do, in the Kildare University, an expert on Saint Bridget, been asked so many questions over the last couple of years around Bridget, and I've been like, I don't know where that idea comes from. And it's funny, so I'm so glad that you have answered that for me. But what I have been able to trace is just that, and I don't want to be flippant. I know I've kind of made a few jokes about it, in a lot of the times in the couple of podcasts, that kind of thing, about this kind of misogynistic and patriarchal, interpretation of the past. But that's the only really meaningful answer I've been able to come up with to explain why so many authors in the 20th century. So I understand Maud Gonne, that makes sense in that political context of the
Right.
time and the nationalism and everything, that yes,
Yeah.
she was going to appeal to different constituencies, which in fairness is exactly how Bridget has been promoted at the minute, that she is something for everyone. Which again is the great appeal of Bridget, and I do think that was part of her appeal in the Middle Ages as well, and that even perhaps as a woman she was able to be to kind of satisfy, it will appeal to more people than often the the male individuals or historical figures are a little bit more static and black and white. I think one of the advantages of perhaps being a woman was, you have to be brilliant at everything to be a woman to achieve anything. So she probably was, multi-talented in every way. But that, I just reading over all the secondary literature about Bridget in the 20th century, just seeing this, why is she being dismissed? I was like, the only way I can account for this is that she is a such a famous and impressive woman in such a difficult society for women that she must have been made up by a man.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's so hard for me then to try to imagine, and I have tried to imagine, to try to give that argument a fighting chance in my own mind, and to try to imagine one of her, any of her early biographers. Cogitosis is the one whose name we know best, who's really promoting Kildare, and trying to imagine him sitting there thinking, well, this woman didn't exist, but I'm going to say we've really been worshiping a goddess around here, and we're not Christians at all, but I'm going to pretend that this woman existed, and I'm going to try to turn this ship around. And I cannot get my head around this possibility. Okay, now, another thing I think about is the fact that there was a pandemic in Ireland in the 540s. So we have this kind of big, a kind of lacuna of the sort that we've all experienced recently between the time of Bridget's life and her actual lived life and the time when the first story of her life is written. So memories, stories can fade during that time. But, you know, we have absolutely the same lacuna between the lived life of Patrick and the time when his first life was written, and the lived life of Columba and the time when his first life was written. Well, fair enough for Patrick, we have some writings by himself, so we'll set him aside for the moment. But, you know, I wonder about Columba. Like, why is his first life story so much more credible than Cogitosis's life of Bridget, even though, you know, Cogitosis is known outside of that life. He's celebrated by one of the biographers of St. Patrick, who says, well, you know, I'm really trying to live up to Cogitosis in telling this story. So,
and as you said, that his text is copied so many times. You know, so many manuscripts survive from the medieval period. The amount of manuscripts that actually survive on any topic for the medieval period, especially Irish texts, is so minute compared to how many would have been produced. You know, like, we have such a poor survival rate. So when you get someone, there are a few texts that really stand out that were so popular that they were copied so many times. If Cogitosis, he wouldn't have gotten away with just like making up a fake female founder for the crack, you know, and you know, he wouldn't have been such a popular text. You know, he wouldn't have been, as I said, you know, kind of copied so many times. It seems he actually, in Cogitosis, I feel, it's so funny when you were talking there, because I was like, I'm the same. I just picture myself, I'm back in the year 600, or I'm Cogitosis at 670 or around, you know, and I'm in Kildare. And he, to me, is at pains to explain, we had a bishop, Conlade, you know, and he administered to the faithful alongside Bridget. And he goes on and on about Conlade a lot. Like, he really, his life would have been a lot easier in a way if there was no female founder of Kildare. I feel like he just wants to talk about Conlade. But Bridget was the real founder of their church, and she is the real saint who was, you know, according to Cogitosis and others, you know, like performing miracles and everything in Kildare in his time, and his faith for her was real, and the people in Kildare, their faith for her was real. So, yeah, it seems really far-fetched to imagine that they just made someone up. That would have been really going to unnecessary lengths.
And in his own time, 100 and however many years after Bridget's death, let's say 140, 150, he's saying that her tomb is there in the
Yeah.
church at Kildare next to Conlaith. So, and he's saying to everybody, you should really come to Kildare and see it. It's quite remarkable, quite a place. Come on down, right? And bring some offerings. But he can't be saying that if there's nothing there. And then we'd have to imagine that the conspiracy to create this fake saint was even bigger than we imagined, because someone has actually made a tomb in which they have put who knows what,
Yeah.
some random person or no one, maybe it's empty. It's just not plausible
And
to me.
especially in the you were bringing up about Patrick and Armagh and everything, I don't think Armagh would have let them away with it at that time. So the wider kind of ecclesiastical context is Armagh and Kildare are kind of vying for primacy of the Irish Church. And Armagh seemed to me again to be slightly embarrassed that they didn't have the body of Patrick, as cogitosis, as you said, is like, it's really quite fantastic what we have coming down in Kildare. You know, spend your holidays in Kildare this year. Don't bother going anywhere else. You know, and as you said, bring your offerings. But you know, Armagh don't have that in relation to Patrick. They have other kind of things going on in Armagh. But they, if they would not have let Cogitosis and Kildare away with this fake tomb of a fake founder, you know, it just, none of it is historically plausible. None of it is borne out by the evidence that we have. But as you said, it does make sense that it was developed many, many, many centuries later in a different political context and a different national context, but totally out of whack with what was actually happening on the ground in the 7th century.
Yeah, no, that's really such a good point you make, Niamh, about that Armagh wouldn't have let them get away with it. That's really true. But why is she so popular? I
Yeah.
mean, because she's great, right? I mean,
Yeah.
even when you go to the earliest sources, you like this woman, don't you? I mean, sometimes she has a bit of a temper. She can get, you know. But she is fundamentally really kind, that she's fundamentally really lives a Christian ideal of loving her neighbor and so on. You know, she and she is and she's different in that way from the way that we see any of the other early saints.
Yeah, it's
She's
very, it's either very genuine, or it's either a genuine portrayal of her, or it's very clever. And I'm okay with that. It could be a clever, you know, literary creation in a way, the way that which she's portrayed, but she does manage to be very likable. She manages to be strong and soft and masculine and feminine and Christ-like and like the Virgin Mary. And she is described in all of these ways in a very seamless manner. It's not clunky, it doesn't seem forced, it does seem very genuine that she was just a very talented female leader who was kind and caring, but firm and confident, and leading, you know, a good Christian life, but also able to function in the real world and in the real society at the time.
there are so many stories that people like to tell and retell about Saint Bridget, many of which don't appear till much later in the tradition. But I think that going back to the early lives, going back to cogitosis, we see such wonderful stories. And as you say, we don't know where they've come from exactly, but they come early, and they are representing a person. And I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of a story where she's visiting a poor widow who, as in her hospitality, to make a fire, she burns her loom, which is the instrument of her, you know, it's her how she makes a living is by weaving. But she burns the loom to create a fire, and she kills her only cow to feed Bridget. And Bridget's miracle there is that she restores these things the next day. All right, it's kind of a marvelous story, but what it shows, I think, is a genuine concern for the poor, particularly the kind of situation that a poor widow could be in. I don't know where this woman's father and sons and so on, who ought to be looking after her, are, but at any rate, she seems to be very much in a isolated widow's situation. And it's that kind of story about Bridget, or when she finds, when there's a girl who's a slave to the king, or who is accused of having stolen a valuable brooch, which Bridget manages to recover. And the implication of the story is clearly that if, because she is branded as a thief, this girl is going to be trafficked, essentially. Mm. She's going to become a sexual slave to the king. And Bridget rescues her from that by finding the brooch in the belly of a fish, as one does. But and I think that the kinds of things that these stories tell us about the kind of human that she was remembered as being really speak to why she would have been loved throughout the world where Irish people went, and spreading that love of her.
Yeah, and I think it might have been Alva Johnston who coined this description of her, which I love, which is patron of the powerless, and that is an image of Bridget that is carried through all the different literary texts. And there are many, like Bridget, she is one of the most written about figures in the medieval period, especially in the early period, when I said we don't have a lot of text surviving. But that is a thread that's carried through everything, as you described her, that she is so connected on a kind of a human level with people, and very much part of that society where it was a really hierarchical society. You had people, you had slaves, you had kings. That story, very well encompassed those two different ends of the spectrum in this society, and that she was able to negotiate with the kings, but also, help and show compassion and practical help to slaves and those, that she really kind of bridged the different ends of society, and that must have been quite appealing.
And I'm thinking about how in studies of Patrick there's a lot of focus on the fact that he describes himself as hanging out with the kings and having king's sons in his retinue, but also as attracting women and also women of very low social position to his following. Mm. And it seems to me that it's exactly that kind of Christian church that Bridget represents in her life. So that she, as you say, negotiates with kings, but is also very caring of people who are at the bottom of the social spectrum, bottom of the ladder there. And, people will talk a lot about how kind she is to animals, and she is. And I love the animal stories, actually. But I think that focusing on just the kind to animals, giving all the butter, giving all the bacon to a dog when there was going to be a party for important people coming on and getting in trouble for that and so on, that just to focus on animals only, it sort of facilitates thinking about her as not really real. Yeah. Whereas if you think about, she's negotiating with kings, and she's being very kind to these women at the bottom of the social ladder, and she's being nice to dogs, you get such a full picture of a wonderful delightful, likable person.
But also it's a, it reflects the society, reflects their other texts. We have texts on cats and we've law texts on cats and dogs, right? Specific law texts and bees. You know, we have poems, you know, Pangar Bawn, you know, so much of our, yeah, our most famous texts actually do focus on animals. I think what we can very definitely say is that animals of all shapes and size were a really important part of medieval Ireland. It was an agricultural society. You had dogs, you had cats, and you had cattle, and you had pigs, and they were integrated into society. So it would be weird, actually, if Bridget, because as you said, she is painted as such a, you know, she's so entrenched in the community. If animals, you know, didn't feature in the stories about her, because animals were part of people's daily lives, they were there all the time. We know that from, it's so funny, we know that from all other texts. And if that's about a man, if a man is connected with an animal some way, that's fine. But Bridget is connected with animals, so this is supernatural now, and she must be an earth goddess, and she's connected with the land and with the ground, and, you know, and the trees, you know, so she's somehow made up, and that this is an example of it. And it's like, no, all the texts are going on with animals all the time. You know, it tells us, I think you really get a good insight into what it was like in the time. Actually, when you were talking there about, you know, the stories in relation to women, as you were talking, I was like, yeah, actually, you know, there is a good bit of a focus on women, you know, stories involving women in the texts about Bridget, and that there must have been an element that, you know, she really represented female religious in early medieval Ireland, and especially if you're talking about Kildare, that, you know, a big constituency must have been Christian women or women in religious orders. You know, the community, the female community of Kildare, and that those stories would have resonated especially with them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think, you know, there's a story about how she, one of her miracles is she heals a mute girl. Mm. But it's so much a question of what we might refer to as giving someone a voice, giving her agency. You know what Bridget says, what do you actually want to do? Do you want to, you know, do you want to be a nun, or do you want to marry whoever your father says? And that enables being asked that question directly by Bridget, by the powerful woman who has established this. The girl is able to say, yeah, I want to be with you. I want this freedom from the standard lot of women, and I want to be with you. And it's a wonderful story about the acquisition of agency, I think, you know, coming to us from the 7th century, and could have been, and it's so contemporary.
You're so right, because I hadn't thought, you know, I just go through all the different miracle stories. That is, she rightly is claimed as the original Irish feminist. As you said, she's literally giving a voice to women in the 7th century, you know, asking their opinion. They didn't have a legal standing, you know, in a way that they were able to exercise agency, you know. Well, listen, that's a debate for another day. But Bridget is, yeah, as you said, she's giving her agency. She's asking her, what do you want? So she's rightly portrayed as a feminist icon in 2024.
Absolutely. Although clearly received well by an awful lot of, yeah, at least religious men in Ireland, because the ones who are making those copies of her life, yep, in Europe are probably not women, yeah, you know. So that's a wonderful little glimpse into the early medieval world as well, I think, that we see for the cult of the Virgin Mary developing, and then alongside it in Ireland, and then spreading from Ireland into Europe with Irish monks, this notion of Bridget, who was just right from the beginning identified as the Mary of the Gael. I mean, they identify her with the Virgin Mary right away. And there's something about that that is profoundly accepting and embracing of what is traditionally and conventionally regarded as the feminine. And I think it's really interesting that that is accepted and celebrated in the Irish Church, and it's not only in Ireland, but in its diaspora in Europe too, with all those copies of the lives being made.
Yeah,
It's fascinating.
it is fascinating. And I think what we've really shown is that she was an really inspiring individual in the earliest sources that we have about her, and presumably in her actual lifetime as well. You mentioned her biggest legacy, in a way, is founding this powerful church of Kildare. And maybe we could talk for a little minute about the women who succeeded her in Kildare.
Well, we, as you mentioned earlier, all of the abbesses of Kildare from then on are regarded as the heir, the coarb of Bridget, right? Many, many of them come from the same population group, the Fahart, that Bridget is associated with quite early on, going back not into the earliest lives where we don't see this, but in some very early sources, she's associated with them. So those abbesses who remain quite powerful, who remain head of that institution, along with a sort of male head of the male monks, right down to the 12th century. And that's when we get the last recorded, abbess of Kildare dying. And of course, it's, I think, sort of past your boundary for this great podcast. But such interesting and different things happen from that period on, that political stuff, when the group who were have been kings of Leinster for all through that early medieval period, the Idunlinga, are replaced by the Hinsula, and they want their own saints. And this horrifying story about in some version of it, Diarmaid McMurrogh himself actually raping the abbess of Kildare so that she, was no longer the virgin nun, and taking possession of Kildare and all it stood for by that sexual act. It's really,
We are actually going the whole way. I mean, so far we've just gone. We actually, it's brilliant that you brought that up, because it's actually just in a recent podcast about Diarmaid McMurrogh, and it's great that you've provided the Bridget angle on it. We are going to be going up until, I don't know, maybe we'll go all the way up until the end of the later medieval period. I wish we had more time to get into some of the kind of other later stories of Bridget and how they developed. But you know what? I think it was really important for us to spend our time focusing on that, kind of as close to all the evidence we have for the real woman herself. And I think we figured out a fairly clear picture of Bridget. Before we wrap up, there's a couple of things we can still discuss. One of them is, I will mention now, is that we are organizing a big Bridget conference in Maynooth in September. So all of kind of the different aspects of this early medieval Bridget are going to be teased out in further detail. And Professor McKenna is coming the whole way over from Harvard. So that will be excellent. So everyone is welcome to that, the 13th to the 15th of September. So just kind of wanted to get out of that out of the way. But if we do kind of, we better touch a little bit on the goddess Bridget, right? We've kind of skirted around it a little bit, but let's kind of spend a few minutes maybe teasing it out a little bit. So as you said, it's the first reference is probably not until the 10th century to the actual goddess Bridget, in a written text anyway, right? I mean, I'd like to hear your opinion on this. I would say, While I don't get any sense of a goddess Bridget at all in the early medieval period, for many hundreds of years, it's this real woman from the Fahart who founded the church in Kildare. And then we get later mentions of a goddess. But having said that, I don't have any problems in theory with there having been a goddess of some similar name to Bridget in pre-Christian Ireland. There could have been. We don't have evidence for it, but I've no issues with that. What's your kind of take on the whole goddess Bridget?
It's similar to yours, actually, Niamh. I mean, I think, for one thing, in this 10th century text, in the Sanus Cormac, where we see the entry on Breed, a goddess of smithcraft and medicine and poetry and so on, we also have a separate entry for Naive Bridget, right? Who is saying, okay, so that text itself seems to differentiate the two, to say there's a goddess Bridget and then there's Saint Bridget. So, okay, maybe there was. I sometimes think that Brigid, this name that means exalted, seems to have been, could have been, what we sometimes call over here in the States a kindergarten name. That is to say, at certain points in time, suddenly all the children, or it seems as if all the children get the same name, you know, and just like a whole cohort. And there, I think this name could have been very common. There are certainly male names that we come across in many different sources referring to many different people, enough repetition of names that it can drive us nuts.
It can be fairly head-wracking trying to differentiate between all people
your,
the same name.
Your yohis and so on, right? So I think that there could have been a goddess, but that Our Lady that we're talking about is a historical woman who founded that church. Whether there were things associated with the goddess that much later crept into her story, I don't know. I think it's impossible to say. I'd love to know, for example, you know, a lot of the folklore and custom associated with Bridget, the Bridget's crosses, for example, the Brat Bridge, the various kinds of things. At the point in history where people are beginning to look at traditional customs like that, they're there. But there's no way to look back further and say, but were they there? Were they making Bridget's crosses in the 15th century? Were they making them in the 12th century? There's no way to find that information. I'd love to know where it came from. I don't know how to go about that.
Oh, I'm glad that you don't know the answer either, because I've been saying to people, I don't know, I can't find it in any early medieval sources, but I've no clue where it came from. You did give a great paper, though, in the Celtic Congress in 2023, tracing back the story of the fire of Bridget and Kildare, which I really enjoyed. And you were kind of tracing it back to the 12th, about what was going on in the later 12th century.
Absolutely. I mean, the earliest reference we have to it is from the later mid 12th century. This was a time at which Kildare had fallen on very hard times over the course of several hundred years. I mean, Viking attacks, civil strife within Ireland, and then the church reform that was a big feature of the 12th century, and the remaking of various Irish churches along the model of continental orders, particularly Augustinian foundations. And I think it makes perfect sense to think that the perpetual fire at Kildare was instituted at that time in the 12th century, and that the nuns who were there in Kildare, and they were in that period, associated it with Bridget and said, yes, she helps us to tend this fire. and may even have suggested that the tradition went all the way back to Bridget, but there's no evidence of it from earlier. And again, I don't know why Cogitosis wouldn't have said, you
Yeah.
know. And another remarkable thing about Kildare is this fire that we keep going. The wonderful story of her spreading, her being granted as much land
Yeah.
as she could spread her cloak on, and spreading her cloak, which miraculously covers the whole Curragh of Kildare. We don't find that until somewhere in like the 16th century,
Yeah,
right?
great. Again,
So,
because that's the only story that they're taught in primary school. So they've picked this story as like the story about Bridget for the younger kids in primary school. So I get asked about it and I'm like they're like scouring all of my texts and everything, being like, I cannot find her cloak is mentioned in fairness by Cogitosis and in all the early texts, but not this whole thing where it's spread everywhere. I'm glad we have the Harvard professor saying, okay, so it's not just that I couldn't find it, it's 16th century. Because I've been looking ever, I was like, I think that's way later. I can't find it anywhere in any medieval texts. So
the cloak on the sunbeam is there in the
the cloak and
medieval
the
texts.
sunbeam. So I just keep on
We love
saying,
the
but there's
cloak on
this
the sunbeam.
much better story about the cloak and the sunbeam that I can tell you kids
Yeah.
about. But it's funny how things anyway, they reflect. I think what you've shown clearly is that the different stories are products of the time in which they were written down anyway, or in which they were created. So whether it's Cogitosis in the 7th century, or what the nuns were doing in the late 12th century, or whether it was, Maud Gonne in the late 19th century, that all the different stories and traditions reflect the time in which they're, being written and promoted.
They certainly do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll find Bridget in some of the 19th century accounts of her life, doing a lot of embroidery,
Yeah, okay, good
like a
thing.
nice Victorian lady, you
Yeah,
know.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, but again, this is the enduring appeal. So now in 2024, and now we've the new public holiday in Ireland, and she's finding, new constituencies again. This the she is the ultimate I don't know, like she has the staying power, so much more staying power
Yeah.
than anyone else. Like Patrick has, the idea of what Patrick is, I think, is fading into, even though he left us written texts, Patrick's day bears so little resemblance to anything that could reflect, Patrick's time or his personality. He's becoming a much vaguer figure, I feel, whereas Bridget is becoming kind of more tangible and more relevant to people. Anyway, there's kind of resurgences. When you said about the kindergarten names, I'm hoping maybe we'll see a lot of little Bridgets running
Yeah.
around now because everyone will have the day off. There'll be all kind of different festivities and everything in Ireland for the day off. So maybe we'll get lots of little Breeds and Bridgets running around in a number of years, and it'll just come into fashion again. And as you said, these things come and go. As per usual, I could talk about this forever. At least we will have Professor McKenna back. We'll have her in Ireland in September for this big Bridget's World is the conference. The name of the conference, Bridget's World, in September. Was there anything else you wanted to add, Catherine, before we go? Or anything else I didn't ask you or that you wanted to that I left out?
Gee, no, I think we've covered most of what was
Yeah.
on my mind. Like you, I hope that the name will come back along with the holiday. I also think, you know, what we see in this development of Bridget's new constituency really is the best side of reinvented traditions and invented traditions. You know, we see a lot of how vague traditions can be misused in the world. And we've seen that a lot in the last few years with the appropriation of so-called Celtic symbols by white supremacist groups. I think in something like the perpetual fire at Kildare, we see the upside of the kind of manipulation of tradition for a good purpose. But it just, and I've been thinking about that a lot lately, getting ready to meet with you today, Niamh, and thinking really, it's one of the things that makes us and our work as medieval historians important, that we have to stand for history, not to say, oh, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to have a fire at Kildare and pretend it goes back to the time of St. Bridget, because it doesn't really. And, you know, we don't have to sort of rain on everyone's parade, but we need to stand for what is actually known about the actual history of Bridget or of Ireland in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, that was very well put. Thank you, yeah, for saying that. Exactly. We're inclusive. Everyone, we want to get as many people as possible interested and involved in medieval Irish history, but you can't just create stuff to suit your own aims necessarily, unless it's for, you know, unless it's benign, you know, and that you're not using it to talk about some idealized version, romantic notion of the past, you know, where we didn't, you know, and it, as you said, it's kind of often framed in kind of ways that we had some kind of like singular, you know, ethnic nation or something, you know, where everyone looked and sounded and the same, which is not how medieval Ireland was at all, not how medieval Wales was, you know, so. The past is fluid, and we have to continue interpreting it and reinterpreting it in different ways, but not to misappropriate either. And there's a balance there. And let's continue the conversation. Let's continue a meaningful conversation about it. So, well, listen, obviously we could talk forever. Thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. We have really enjoyed talking to you. We're looking forward to seeing you in September.
That's right. Thank you for having me, Niamh. I've enjoyed this enormously, and I look forward very much to seeing you at Maynooth in September.
Thanks again, and happy Bridget's Day to all the listeners. Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying the podcast episodes. If you want to contact us, you can get onto us, email medievalirishhistory@gmail.com. You can follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Early Irish Pod. Wherever you get your podcasts, if you could please do the usual like and subscribe, but also rate and review, as that will help us to reach more listeners. And we will be back again in 2 weeks' time. Bye.